25 years after 1989, of 1989, this is a series, so Platypus puts together these large discussions, and this one is an international series. So the first one happened in Frankfurt not too long ago, the second one's happening here, the third one will happen in our Poland chapter, and hopefully there will be other chapters that will do this as well. We're hoping to translate and publish these different talks as either part of a small book or in our newspaper publication, which is back there, the Platypus Review. I'm going to say just a couple of words about Platypus, and then I'll let Tom take it away with the introductions and the event itself. Platypus got started back in 2006. We started first as a reading group. It was during the Second Iraq War. It's a very confusing time to be on the left, and a lot of us experience this sort of disillusionment about the possibilities of overcoming capitalism during that time. And so we decided to create some sort of educational political project that would help us understand what the current state of the left is, the history of the left, and its potential future. Therefore, we put together journalism and public forum discussions as well as reading groups. And if you're interested in any of these things that happen in New York City, there's a little information sheet back there. We are pretty active in North America, but as of late, we have the opportunity to do our work in Europe, so in places like Germany, as well as the UK, and Greece, and hopefully, and Kosovo, and in Poland, and hopefully, sometime soon, we'll be working with folks in South America as well. I am currently the coordinator for the organization in Europe, and so if you have any questions about that, you can ask me. Otherwise, if you have questions about Platypus, feel free to approach anyone with a Platypus button. And I think that's it for me. I'll let you introduce the event itself.
Okay. My name is Thomas Willis. I'm a member of Platypus, and I was also one of the people involved in putting this event series together. I won't take too long, but just the general idea behind it was that, sort of the three main people who were behind the initiative were all people born after 1989, or not born after 1989, but who came to sort of political consciousness after 1989, and were disconcerted by the way that this issue is largely not discussed, especially not in any serious detail, on the left, at least in the U.S. So we have brought together a range of different speakers from different viewpoints who were active at the time and hope to foment a bit of a critical discussion here on 1989 that otherwise wouldn't take place. So the three speakers that we have in order of their appearance are first Christoph Lichtenberg. Christoph is a supporter of the International Bolshevik Tendency, and he is the editor of their German-language journal, Bolshevik. He was active on the German left in the 80s and 90s before moving to first the UK and then eventually the US. Second will be Boris Kagarlitsky, who is a well-known international commentator on Russian politics and society. He was a deputy to the Moscow City Soviet between 1990 and 1993, during which time he was a member of the executive of the Socialist Party of Russia, co-founder of the Party of Labor, and advisor to the chairperson of the Federation of Independent Trade Unions of Russia. Previously, he was a student of art criticism and was imprisoned for 2 years for anti-Soviet activities. And finally is Mel Rothenberg, who is currently a professor emeritus of mathematics at University of Chicago and has a long history on the left and activism dating back to 1948. Participating in the civil rights and anti-war movements, and he's also the author of numerous articles and books, including most relevantly The Myth of Capitalism Reborn with Michael Goldfield. So just very briefly, and then I'll let everyone go into things, we have about 18 minutes for each speaker to give comments. After that, there will be about a 20-minute panelist response section where panelists will have sort of a structured back and forth, and then we'll open things up to the floor for question and answer from the audience. So without further ado, Christoph.
Okay, so welcome everybody. First of all, thanks to the Platypus Affiliated Society for inviting me. I'm going to speak about the collapse of what's commonly referred to as East Germany, I like to call it DDR, as it's known by its German acronym, the German Democratic Republic. And I really want to talk about, briefly, what was the DDR, what happened in 1989-90, so a brief summary of the events, and then finally, what was the response of revolutionary socialists at the time to these events. So let me start by briefly describing how we see the DDR. The DDR was, of course, a product of the Cold War, but it should be noted that it was actually historically more progressive than its Western counterpart, and I'm going to explain why I think that. Now, it was ruled by the Stalinists. The regime was a Stalinist regime, which suppressed the workers and which ultimately ruined the economy, because a planned economy, which existed in the DDR, cannot be run successfully without the participation of the workers. And in the DDR, the workers did not really participate in the planned economy in a meaningful way. However, the DDR also had a number of significant social gains. These included, for example, free medical care, universally available child care facilities, it had easy access to abortion, and it had virtually full employment. So in summary, all of these things that the people in the United States would benefit from were actually available to the citizens of the DDR. It was, in our view, a deformed worker state, and in a way it was very similar in its structure to the Soviet Union. It was ruled by the Stalinists, as I said, but these Stalinists rested on the planned economy. And while the planned economy was undemocratic, it still was a planned economy. It was running society differently to how it is done under capitalism. Under capitalism, you have profit as the highest principle. That was not the case in the planned economies of Eastern Europe, in the Soviet Union or the DDR. Now, the events that unfolded in 1989-1990 had, in my view, two important precursors in preceding years. One was the rise of Solidarność in Poland, when in 1980 the Polish workers founded an independent union of workers. They organized an opposition to the ruling Stalinists. And it unfortunately became a pro-capitalist formation by 1981 and rose to power in Poland in 1989-1990. The important part here, though, is for the workers in East Germany, in the DDR, they could look to Poland and see that the workers organized against the ruling elite. That was something that they remembered and took inspiration from. In many ways, for the wrong political reasons, but it is an important precursor to what unfolded in the DDR, I believe. And the other important factor is, of course, the regime of Gorbachev in the Soviet Union, which brought glasnost and perestroika. Glasnost being a more transparent way of operating, and perestroika restructuring, which often meant a restructuring of the planned economy in favor of pro-capitalist measures, of allowing joint ventures with Western companies. And most importantly, perhaps, for the events in the DDR, was Gorbachev's statement that he basically would have an attitude of non-interference towards events in other Eastern Bloc countries, in other Warsaw countries. Now, the regime in the DDR actually rejected the cause of Gorbachev. They were not big fans of Gorbachev. Mm-hmm. They were very worried about Gorbachev. So they rejected Gorbachev, but the population in the DDR increasingly rejected the regime of the DDR. Because many people in the DDR wanted reforms. They actually looked to Gorbachev as someone who was having a positive influence, they believed. They wanted real participation in running society. People wanted an end to the travel restrictions that were imposed on them. Ordinary citizens in the DDR were not allowed to travel to the West. They could only vacation in Warsaw Bloc countries. And they wanted an end of the monopoly of the ruling SED party. I mean, one interesting fact is that the Russian magazine Sputnik was actually banned in the DDR. And, you know, we're talking about a relatively popular magazine from Russia that was not allowed to be published in German in the DDR. Maybe Boris can talk a little bit about the meaning of Sputnik magazine, but it was quite telling that this magazine was not allowed to be bought in shops in the DDR. So in the course of 1989, many different cities in the DDR see demonstrations. People going out on the streets and talking about how they want reforms of the existing regime. Now these demonstrations and the developments were somewhat accelerated by events in Hungary, because Hungary actually removed the border fences in May of 1989 and stopped all border controls by September, which meant that the border was open, pretty much. Many people, many citizens of the DDR actually left via Hungary or via the West German embassies in Czechoslovakia and the DDR in Poland and actually traveled to the West. So throughout the autumn, the demonstrations grow in size in the DDR. So you can see that there were sort of two tendencies. One was those people who simply wanted to leave the DDR, who wanted to go west, and they left. Nearly a quarter million people left in 1989 from the DDR to West Germany, many of them young people. And the other tendency that emerged were those people, and that was the majority, who wanted to see reform of the DDR, reform of the existing regime. And I want to emphasize that at this time, reforms did not mean simply capitalist democracy. It meant that they wanted to have something better. Many people talked about socialism of the DDR, that they wanted to make work for them, that they wanted to have a better, more genuine socialism. So different political tendencies emerged in the course of the autumn. And I just want to give you a flavor of the different political tendencies that emerged. Early on, you had the Social Democrats who emerged and Democracy Now. There were social democratic parties, and as such, they were pro-capitalist. They did not really want socialism. They were in favor of Western-style democracy and capitalism. They were counterparts to the German Social Democrats. You had the New Forum, which was very much led by intellectuals. They sort of attempted to unite all of the people of the DDR for democratic reforms. And the unification of all of the people didn't quite work for them, because in January 1990, their right wing actually split off because they said, we don't want to have anything to do with any socialist projects. Then there was the United Left, perhaps the most left-wing formation in the DDR. The United Left called for a socialist alternative, a left socialist alternative in the DDR, and contained several different political tendencies, including former members of the ruling Stalinist Party. They had about 1,500 members or so, but very few workers joined the United Left. You also had conservative forces emerge very quickly. The German Social Union was basically the counterpart of the Western Christian Democrats, a very, very conservative formation. And last but not least, there was the Independent Women's Union, which really was the beginning of the feminist movement in the East, combining the old Women for Peace as well as a number of lesbian activists. They later on joined an electoral bloc with the Greens in 1990. So there was a lot of political turmoil at the time. And by September, October, you have mass demonstrations in all of the major cities. You have small demonstrations in tiny towns where a couple of hundred people will rally in front of Stalinist party headquarters and demand resignations. The whole country was moving. While many of these protests were peaceful and often organized by church activists because they had some sort of independent structure, it wasn't always peaceful. There was the Battle of Dresden at Dresden Central Station, where mainly young people fought riot police and with stones, that's all they had, and set police cars on fire, expressing their anger and frustration. So in those events, the Stalinists really lost control. Their monopoly of power, which had existed and had been enshrined in the constitution for so long, for 40 years, was finally broken. A lot of people realized, we don't need them, And the ruling party was no longer sure that anybody would really follow their orders. So it was really broken, that monopoly, through mass action. They were looking for an alternative to the real existing socialism. So finally, it culminates on November 9th when the ruling party of DDR declares that all restrictions on travel were lifted, and this announcement became known as the fall of the Berlin Wall, when people were allowed to travel to the West. And this also marked a little bit of a watershed in the dynamics. After the fall of the wall, and definitely by December, I would say, the mood in the East was changing. It was changing towards more people basically coming out in favor of reunification. Reunification had not been on the agenda for the first few months at all. But I would say by December, more and more people were talking about it. And you can see it in the way that the slogans on demonstrations changed. The old slogan was, in the October, was "We are the people," expressing the desire of the population to say, we should be in charge, we are the people. This changed by December to "We are one people," expressing their desire for uniting with Western Germany. But there was widespread concern about reunification. Many people feared that reunification could actually be more like an annexation of the DDR by West German capitalism. And it was no surprise that 250,000 people actually came out to demonstrate against fascist vandalism at the Soviet War Memorial in Berlin. Many people were still holding on to principles of what they believed were socialist and good principles. The elections on March the 18th gave the Alliance for Germany an overwhelming majority. There was a coalition of conservative forces, and the SPD was defeated. And really, all the new parties that had emerged in the autumn were basically wiped out in the election. Nobody really cared about them. The majority of people voted for the Christian Democrats or the Alliance for Germany, which really set the course for reunification. One of the important factors is, in all of these events, that the working class did not really enter the political stage as a conscious force. There were some economic strikes and some formation of shop steward committees, but there was no organized working class acting, conscious of its own role and of its own power. So I think I want to spend the last 4 or 5 minutes that I have on what I believe was the right political perspective at the time. So the predecessors of the international Bolshevik tendency were the German Group 4 of the National and the Bolshevik tendency, and both formations put out very similar propaganda at the time and eventually refused for very similar reasons, because we realized we were very different, very similar in our approach. We called for the formation of workers' councils at the time because we wanted to call on workers to set up alternative power to the Stalinists, but also to create a formation against the danger of reintroduction of capitalism. We participated in protests and argued for workers' democracy instead of the Stalinist police state. And as Trotskyists, we always said that we were for the defense of the social gains that I mentioned earlier in my talk against the danger of capitalist reunification. We put out this pamphlet in January 1990, which said, "Bankruptcy of Stalinism, fight against capitalist counter-revolution for proletarian political revolution." That was our perspective at the time. Now, we were not particularly popular with that perspective, but I think it was the right perspective to have. Mm-hmm. And that's what we fought for. And the problem really was that in the absence of a revolutionary party at the time, the workers of the DDR didn't really see a viable alternative to capitalist reunification. They couldn't imagine or couldn't see the alternative material force that could create something better than what they had already rejected, and something better than what was offered to them, which was capitalism. There was an absence of an alternative because there was an absence of a revolutionary party at the time. How much time do I have left?
Let me check. I think you have somewhere around 4 minutes.
Okay. Then perhaps by contrast...
Three.
By contrast, I want to talk a little bit about some of the failures of, I think, a lot of people and groups on the left. Overall, I think the response of the left to these events was abysmal. A lot of the so-called socialists in the West became simply cheerleaders for democratic change. They put the unity of the working class that would be achieved by reunification above any class principles. They celebrated the end of Stalinism as if this would usher into an era of freedom for the working class. And I think this happened because many groups on the left did not really appreciate the real social gains that existed in the DDR or in the Soviet Union. They simply looked at, oh, here's a lack of democracy. Let's bring some democracy. That's going to be good. No. Their understanding was very much a liberal point of view. We want to have more democracy, more unity of the working class. And considerations of real social gains that were there did not really enter their so-called analysis. So the freedom that the workers of the DDR and all of the citizens enjoyed after reunification consisted mainly of a complete destruction of the DDR industry. There was mass unemployment in the East within a few years because whatever existed of East German industry was basically put to the ground. There were areas where unemployment was 25-30%. All of these workers were put out of work. Nothing was there to replace it. That was one of the immediate effects of capitalist reunification. So as I said, the defense of the DDR was critical at the time. It was not a popular thing to do, but I believe that you have to say what is actually necessary. The defense of different worker states did not mean that you defended the Stalinists. You didn't want to create a sort of unity with the Stalinists, as the German Spartacist group, by the way, did. What you wanted was to warn against German reunification, but also to warn against the sort of reform wing of the Stalinist apparatus that was emerging, represented by Hans Modrow and Gregor Gysi, who became the people who sold out the DDR to West German imperialism. And you needed to call it by its right name and say, these people are selling out the DDR, and capitalist reunification will bring misery to the workers. I think we were proved correctly, and unfortunately, it's the workers of the eastern parts of Germany that had to pay a very heavy price for their political mistake to endorse capitalist reunification. Thank you.
Thank you, Christoph. Okay, next up will be Boris.
Okay, I think that much of the story is already told in terms of facts and how the process happened. And of course, you shouldn't forget that in case of Russia, the events actually took place somewhat later, because for us, the actual change which happened in Eastern Europe in 1989 happened 2 years later in 1991. Which doesn't mean much, because basically it was the same process, and it was just a process which continued for a period of time, and the dynamics and the logic of the process was very similar. And here are a few questions which are absolutely essential for the left to address, both post-factum and in terms of kind of analyzing the potential future struggles. Because if we are looking at the process from a left-wing point of view, what we discover is that there was definitely a change of what could be presented as a dominant ideology of the critical movements. And Christoph already mentioned that the ideology of the movement changed, so that initially people were in favor of reforming DDR, and already a few months later, they were already more and more excited about reunification. Though, by the way, I think that we have to be very clear that people didn't think of reunification in terms of it being capitalist restoration. In fact, it was, and it had to be, and there was no other way, objectively. But we have also to consider how people saw that. And in that sense, they considered the process of reunification not in the terms of capitalist restoration like we do as socialists and Marxists. But they, we have to be very clear. Most of people are not socialists and Marxists. And even when they're socialists, they're not necessarily Marxists. You have just to have it in mind. You don't have to kind of expect everybody to be like yourself. And you have to consider these differences to begin with. And unless you do that, you will be hardly capable of really mobilizing the masses, because the masses are not necessarily going to accept whatever you say, because they have their own vision, they have their own illusions, but these illusions also have some objective reasons. They're not coming from nowhere, and they're not coming just from the quote-unquote enemy propaganda, from the bourgeois propaganda. There are other reasons for these illusions to emerge. And unless you understand that, you're going to fail time and again. And this is, by the way, one of the first lessons we have to draw out of this story. But coming back to the story, an important issue here is that if you're looking at the opposition to the Stalinist regimes in Eastern Europe, and even to some extent in the Soviet Union, throughout the period of, say, 1960s to 1980s, what you discover is that initially much of the opposition shared socialist goals. So most of the dissidents in East Central Europe were kind of left-wingers, different sorts of left-wingers, from social democrats to Trotskyists, to what we can call authentic Leninists. So that was another very typical current in many countries, people who were saying that basically they were not so much in disagreement with anything which was which formed the communist ideology, of the official communist ideology. They basically shared the official communist ideology. The problem was that the ruling elites did not act according to this very ideology. And so that was a very strong current in the Soviet Union, but also in other Eastern European countries. But if you're taking GDR, take people like Rudolf Barrow, for example, and so on, he claimed to be a kind of Eurocommunist, and so on. If you're taking Czechoslovakia, again, who were the main characters associated with the opposition? People from the Prague Spring. And again, we can be very critical of Prague Spring, but one thing has to be very clear: that Prague Spring was initially calling, and was for a short period of time when it continued, because it was suppressed, as we know, in 1968 it was suppressed by the Soviet intervention, but it was calling for democratic socialism, and it was calling for democratic reforms, not only in terms of liberal democracy, but also in terms of workers' participation, workers' councils, and so on. Actually, some workers' councils survived as late as till 1969. So there was a whole period. There was the so-called Second Prague Spring, when workers continued resisting when the actual political leaders surrendered, and workers' councils were still there at the factory level. So, again, if you take Hungary, even Poland, by the way, Poland was an exception, but still, if you take Poland, even there you could see people like Jacek Kuroń, Karol Modzelewski, and even Adam Michnik, who is alive and well now as one of the leading right-wing liberal figures in Poland, but who started his career as a dissident, publishing a good book called "Left: The Church and the Left in Poland," which he discussed the relations between the church and the left from a left-wing perspective. So he initially was a left-winger. So in Russia, again, it was much more mixed, much more kind of contradictory picture, but again, there were quite visible tendencies represented by some sort of left-wing opposition, including meaning among the younger generation, including people like myself and my friends. But also, you should see that there were two different types of opposition to Stalinism within Soviet Union, but also within the Eastern Bloc, because there were people who were more or less loyal to the system and who wanted to reform it from inside and to improve it. Not necessarily even reform, rather improve. Correct, improve. And by the way, these people ended up in East Germany in Die Linke, first in the Party for Democratic Socialism, yep. And then in Die Linke in Germany, the left party of Germany. And of course, there were people who wanted to transform, to change the system, but from a left-wing perspective, from a radical socialist perspective. And there were always disagreements and debates between these people. But again, compared to the logical restoration of capitalism, both of these tendencies can be seen as the left in a broad sense. So the question is, where did it all go? Why it all disappeared? Because we see that it all went under very, very fast. So if we take the events of 1989, it's very clear that the left collapsed politically extremely fast in most of these countries. Mm-hmm. And I think, of course, there can be two different explanations which do not contradict each other necessarily, but are rather complementary. Because on the one hand, of course, we have to see that it was very much the ruling elite within most of Eastern European countries, probably, by the way, with the exception of East Germany, which had a project, and it was, from the very beginning, a project of capitalist restoration, while the opposition didn't have a project. And ironically, very often, it was the opposition which was actually doing the work for the ruling elite. Especially in Russia, it was very visible, but also in Poland and so on. So the old bureaucracy was pretty happy about capitalist restoration because, as we later stated it for Russia, but it was the case everywhere, it was a possibility of converting political power into capitalist property. And then back into power, by the way. Because then you reconvert property into power. Once you're into capitalist development, then property becomes power. So you're not losing anything, you're just getting more. And you see, the system was definitely in crisis, but it was exactly the ruling elite, the ruling bureaucracy, which benefited from the crisis and which developed its own strategy of getting out of this crisis. Just recently, it was about half a year ago in Prague, we had a conference, I was at a conference with the colleagues from the Czech Academy of Sciences. It was very interesting because these days Czech intellectuals are very critical about what happened in 1989. Though we have to remember that in Czechoslovakia people were extremely enthusiastic about this change happening, and now we have the intellectuals who are very, very critical, and not only the young ones. And much of the discussion was about how the liberals within the opposition and some segments of the old elite, people like Václav Klaus, for example, who was in the old elite and he continued to be in the new government and so on, how they manipulated the situation to marginalize the left, to marginalize the people from the Prague Spring, the old socialist dissidents, and how they politically outmaneuvered them and managed to push them aside and defeated them politically, even before the left understood that there was a struggle going on. So in that sense, the left was very weak politically. It was very weak in terms of strategizing, developing its own project, uniting, politically forming itself into something strategically incapable of winning and fighting. But this is only part of the problem, because Christoph mentioned the working class. And you see, by the way, I think Russia was the only country in East Central Europe and Eastern Europe where the working class really did give a fight. Because there were strikes, there were massive strikes in 1992, by the way, not in 1993, when the final battle was fought and when the regime of Boris Yeltsin actually organized the coup d'etat and defeated everybody opposing the neoliberal reform. The most important strikes and resistance activities of the working class happened in 1992, and they were defeated already, in a certain sense, by 1992, at least people started getting demoralized. But there are two important things to note. That, first of all, this resistance of the working class still was a passive resistance of atomized masses, which were atomized by the Stalinist system itself. The Stalinist system created a situation where and when people didn't have much of a collective experience outside their jobs, and all their collective interests were in one way or another served by the state. It was not something they had to manage, they had to control, they had to achieve, and the new generation even didn't remember that it had to be fought for. And I completely agree with Christoph that social achievements of Eastern European countries were absolutely without precedent. I think it was, in social terms, it was the best welfare state ever achieved by humanity. By the same time, it was a welfare state based on what my colleague Anna Ochkina calls passive democracy, in the sense that you're passive and you're just getting your rights. And you expect these rights to be guaranteed. You take it for granted. And it's absolutely typical for these people in Eastern Europe to think that, well, free education, free healthcare, cheap transportation, cheap housing, upward mobility possibilities, and so on, it is taken for granted. It's something natural. It is self-evident that it's going to stay there no matter what. But at the same time, what was lacking? Well, yes, Western-style democracy was lacking, but also consumer goods were lacking. Mm-hmm. And very often people called for more democracy when they thought about consumer goods rather than democracy. Very often that was exactly what they've got. They've got more consumer goods rather than more democracy. But the point is that people didn't have class consciousness, not only because the left didn't do its work well, but because of the social experience under Stalinism, which actually generated individualists and consumerists of a sort. So that your social rights are guaranteed by the state. What you do on your own, what you have to achieve on your own, is to get more consumer goods, to achieve specific individual goals. Here you train, you practice your capabilities, you know. You develop your brain and your capacities in achieving that. So in that sense, we've got a society of individualists. And that is, by the way, one of the results of Stalinist welfare state, which generated these huge numbers of individualists. That was one of the reasons why the left was so weak, and also why the working class resistance in the former Soviet Union was defeated so easily, because people didn't have the experience and the capacity to organize effectively, to fight back. And finally, the struggles of 1992 were the predictably defeated struggles of the old Soviet type of society. Once the society started changing, the new class structure, the new social structure started emerging, the old Soviet working class disappeared. It doesn't mean that the working class disappeared as such, but the type of a working class which we had in the Soviet Union, it did disappear with the Soviet system. And what we have now, for example, in Russia, is a very typical contradiction that we have old Soviet enterprises which are still surviving with the old Soviet type of labor relations and workers who can, for example, say that we can't fight for our rights because the enterprise is privatized. I said, what? I said, yes, because there is nowhere to send a letter of complaint.
That's how you used to do it.
Yeah, yes, that's how they fought. That's how they thought or think of fighting for their rights in the third times. And at the same time, you go, we did a few interviews in Kaluga, which is a region which is considered to be industrially developing, successfully industrially developed in today's Russia. Mm-hmm. So we go to an old, very famous factory, the Kalugsky Turbinny Zavod, and there you meet workers who say that we can't fight because there is nowhere to file a complaint, because the factory is private. And then you go to the new factory, which is owned by Volkswagen. And then you speak to workers there. These are young workers, and they have very clear class consciousness. They speak about the bosses and us, our interests, our rights, and so on. And then when you speak to them in more detail, then you see that they have a trade unionist consciousness. Mm-hmm. That these are definitely good trade unionist workers, but not anything else than that. It's not like you're speaking to a crowd of socialists or communists. Mm. And, what has to be done? We have to work in terms of building up broader coalitions of different segments of labor and working people to bring them together, and at the same time to develop their consciousness through struggles and through uniting them in these struggles. So it's a combination of acting, educating, and learning ourselves, because that's what I started with. We had to learn how to speak to people and how to learn from our own experience and our own errors, because without doing that, we are doomed to stay marginalized, and I don't want to stay marginalized for the rest of my life. I spent already so many years fighting against the wall, trying to break the walls, and there are always new walls. And at some point of my life, I think I want to spend the rest of my life doing something which can really change the society. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, and the final speaker will be Mel. Take it away.
Again, thanks for inviting me to participate in this interesting panel. The topic for today is the fall of the Soviet Union and its impact on the left. This is a huge topic, and I want to deal with some particular general issues. Both the previous speakers have talked about the details, more about the details of the collapse of the Soviet rule, and I'm going to talk in a different vein about some general issues that are raised that preceded the fall and remain, I think, some fundamental questions for the Marxist left. And by the Marxist left, I mean for this discussion, I have and you'll see why, I have a rather broader definition than the other speakers. Roughly, I'm talking about those forces whose primary frame of reference is support for the international working class struggle, as first comprehensively theorized in the writings and political activity of Karl Marx. This is a broader array of political forces than those who describe themselves as communists, Maoists, or Trotskyists, although it, of course, includes them. It includes left-wing social democrats and anti-imperialist and revolutionary nationalists, from Nkrumah to Stokely Carmichael, who played a major leadership role in the anti-colonial struggles. It is narrower than the broader category of progressives who see some kind of socialism as the ultimate desirable form of social organization, and who also form an important layer of political activists. But I want to focus on people who consciously identify with Marx, but who are not what we would describe as communists or the other aspects of communism. Although most, in fact, of all of the Marxist left was taken by surprise by the sudden collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, the Soviet Union and its bloc's rapid decline socially, economically, and politically over the previous decade should have been evident. What complicated the politics of the Marxist left during the 1980s, and this is one of the, my main theses, is that this period also saw the rapid decline in all Marxist left movements. Not only the pro-Soviet CPs. The earlier retreat of mainline social democracy and all its major organizations into social welfare capitalists stranded the left-wing social democrats without an organizational home. Maoism was routed in China, its center. And perhaps most importantly, most of the post-colonial regimes whose creation was the achievement of the international anti-imperialist forces abandoned an independent non-capitalist path of development and embraced or were forced to embrace neoliberalism. Thus, the collapse of the Soviet Union was the fourth major defeat and literally the straw that broke the camel's back as far as the Marxist left was defined. The decline of the Marxist left as a major social force during the 1980s was then based on fundamental social, political, economic developments, of which the collapse of the Soviet Union was only the most dramatic and conclusive. The crucial question is not why the Marxist left declined at the end of the 20th century, but why 15 years into the 21st century there has not been a substantial revival, given the contradictions and failures of unchallenged capitalism rule over the past 25 years. Some might claim this is because of the differences, the lack of political unity among the remaining Marxist forces. These differences are indeed sharp, but my second thesis is that it's not the differences, but the failed strategic premises which they have in common that is at root of the failure of the revival of Marxism. These premises were supported, reinforced, and strengthened by Soviet policy and by Chinese and anti-colonial politics. They were not invented or imposed, but arose out of the real conditions of struggle of the first half of the 20th century. They are deep and organically embedded and grounded in the international experience and politics of the Marxist left. And that is why they were not really challenged despite the massive failures of the 1980s. However, I argue that they are inadequate for the 21st century unless they are fundamentally revised and recast to reflect the current reality. There can be no revival of a Marxist left as the core of a major social movement. That's my third thesis, my final thesis. So what are these strategic premises? I have only time to be extremely broad and sketchy, and for concreteness I will focus on the U.S., which I know the most about, although much of what I say applies with some regional variations internationally. I want to emphasize that three basic areas of struggle, the trade unions, the struggle against colonialism, and racial oppression, and the electoral arena. Let me start with the colonial and racial oppression. The movement against racial oppression was the most important World War II domestic U.S. struggle, while the struggle against colonialism was the most important international battle. U.S. Marxists, while never gaining hegemony, played a crucial and honorable role in the domestic struggle, as did international Marxist forces in the broader international anti-colonial struggle. Way beyond their number, U.S. Marxists played key organizing and tactical leadership roles and are among the most militant, courageous, and self-sacrificing activists. Ideologically, the central contribution of U.S. Marxists was to link the U.S. anti-racist struggle to the world anti-colonial struggle. The roots of this went back to the Communist International of the 1920s, which laid down and promoted the theoretical analysis that supported this linkage. This was further developed, if watered down somewhat, in the United Front politics that dominated the communist movement from the late 1930s. In contrast, the leading force in the U.S. civil rights movement remained the African-American middle class, whose focus was on ending Jim Crow and whose ideas were dominated by the social democratic concepts of integration. After the abandonment of the movement by white liberals, who rejected the more radical class-oriented demands of the black masses for jobs, decent schools, housing, and well-maintained neighborhoods, and having achieved their aims with the federal outlawing of formal segregation in the mid-1960s, the black middle class itself abandoned the movement, leaving it unprepared to confront the coming era of neoliberal deindustrialization. This deindustrialization led to the economic ruin of much of the black working class. A new leadership of radicalized black youth and revolutionary and revolutionary nationalist and radicalized black youth, Stokely Carmichael, the Black Panthers, along with black nationalist leaders such as Malcolm X, attempted to pick up the reins, many of them influenced by an older generation of Marxists. And they made a valiant attempt to integrate revolutionary black nationalism with Marxism. However, this leadership was strangled in, as it got its early start by savage police and social repression, and by 1980s, the black movement was moribund. Marxists played an important role in deepening the international consciousness of the black movement, not only directly influencing the revolutionary wing led by such figures as Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, but also more indirectly influencing the more moderate mainstream leadership. Martin Luther King, who was a centrist social democrat, not a Marxist, broke with mainline liberalism in repudiating the Vietnam War, much of this due to pressure from the new layer of emerging Marxist African-American activists, as well as the older Marxist left. The fatal weakness of the revolutionary nationalist approach is that it depended on the national liberation struggles worldwide retaining their anti-capitalist character. With the capitulation of most post-colonial regimes to neoliberalism and their abandonment of a non-capitalist path of development, which was perhaps the greatest defeat of international Marxism in the 20th century, the wind went out of the sail of revolutionary nationalism, and nationalism became captive to the reactionary racists, ethnic chauvinists, and religious fundamentalists. Marxists never transcended the framework of the early 20th century Marxist anti-imperialist strategy, which relied on revolutionary national liberation movements, but which is no longer as adequate to engage or even understand the powerful resistance to imperialism, a resistance which remains a major international social force. In particular, in the U.S., there is no real Marxist analysis of the collapse of the African-American movement during the 1980s, nor the international rise of religious fundamentalism in the 1990s. The second topic I want to raise is the question of trade unions. Since the time of Marx, Marxists have recognized the importance of trade unions in pursuing the class struggle and the necessity of Marxist participation in trade union organization and struggle. In Europe, Marxists were in the leadership of much of the of initial organized labor. But in the U.S., where industrial unions were late in coming, organized labor was dominated by craft unions, which generally were reformist, narrow, and often racist. Later in Europe, when the socialist movement split into the revolutionary communist wing and the reformist social democrats, much of organized labor went with the reformists. Even before this, Lenin, Gramsci, and other major Marxist thinkers had pinpointed the central problem of Marxists working in the trade unions. The consciousness of workers generated by trade union activity was trade union consciousness, which is how to extract a better deal from the employer. Trade union activity in itself does not lead to desire or a strategy for getting rid of the capitalist employer altogether, which is the center of politics for a socialist revolutionary. Trade union activity, even in very militant form, was in a real sense a form of bargaining over the price of labor power, a form of class collaboration. The Marxist mainstream rejected the syndicalist solution to this, which was to form revolutionary unions, such as the IWW, which didn't sign collective bargaining agreements. Marxists rather accepted the basic role of unions was promoting the immediate economic interests of their members while reserving socialist parties as a location for developing socialist consciousness. For Marxists, unions became the arena where the working class militancy could be nourished and where the most active and committed workers could be recruited into the party, where they could be trained and developed as revolutionaries. The Communist International laid down this conception from the beginning. And after the fading of syndicalists in the 1920s, it has remained the dominant view of all sections of the organized Marxist left. This conception of trade union activity led to positions of influence of Marxism in some important U.S. unions, and even hegemony in some of the unions that communists founded. It was, however, a position of non-struggle within the unions, which were accepted as they were, and a position designed to be non-threatening to the main non-Marxist leadership, whose organizational power, policy, and leadership was rarely challenged. While the unions were expected to unite workers in their economic demands in the face of employer resistance, there was little systematic attempt to build democracy and fight bureaucratic despotism, which was widespread within the unions. The struggle for workers' power within unions and within shop was abandoned, particularly during the United Front period, which the communists considered when the communists considered the reformist labor leaders as a key partner. The central problem with this approach is that unless for some reason, which never happened in the U.S. or elsewhere, the workers spontaneously join the party in mass, trade union consciousness is never transcended among the majority of workers. The idea that a rising level of struggle and militancy by itself would deliver the workers into the arms of the party, which Lenin, Gramsci, and others had convincingly rejected at the theoretical level, remained the governing principle at the practical level. There was no real strategy for serious propaganda or education at the shop floor level. Marxists had no organic role in the shop floor other than as militant trade unionists. The result that it was easy for capitalists, with the collaboration of the reformists, to purge Marxists from the shop floor and from any position of influence in the union hierarchy when the political wind changed after World War II. The massive workers who accepted the Reds as militant trade unionists would abandon them when it was revealed that the Marxists had deeper political ambitions. After all, they never really shared these aims with the great majority of workers. After the post-World War II purges of the left and the trade unions, Marxists ceased to be a presence on the shop floor, although they managed to hold on to certain minor staff positions in the more liberal reformist unions. Ideologically committed to the working class and trade union work, they were capable, honest, low-level bureaucrats. The rise of the new left saw a rise in militancy of the working class in the 60s and 70s and a new generation of Marxists in the plants and into the lower levels of the trade union apparatus. The decline of the strategy of boring from within, however, has not essentially changed. With the decline of the Marxist left, beginning with the 1980s, and with the decline of manufacturing, most of the Marxists on the shop floor left voluntarily or were laid off. A number remain in the ranks of the trade union apparatus, but with the serious decline of trade unions, they are demoralized along with the majority of trade union staffers. The lack of a viable trade union strategy haunts the Marxist left. Despite the decline of trade unionism, the trade unions remain the core of working class organizations, and a revival of the Marxist movement is inconceivable without some kind of workplace organizing. If that is to happen, however, whether in the revival of the existing trade unions or in some new form of worker organization, Marxists will have to play a significant role. For this, they need a viable strategy which integrates immediate organizational tasks with a sophisticated understanding of the importance of bringing Marxism to the mass of workers. The old strategy, whatever its accomplishments in its time, never succeeded in challenging bourgeois hegemony at the point of production, and for that reason must be transcended. Now, I have another section on electoral politics, but I'm running out of time. So I'm going to just make just 2 minutes on electoral politics, and then I'll quit.
You have 3 minutes.
You have 3 minutes. Okay. The problem of electoral politics for Marxists is the double nature of bourgeois electoral politics. I'm referring mainly now to the advanced industrialized capitalist societies. On the one hand, it is the one arena where politics is openly and legitimately debated. Electoral activity and lobbying the state apparatus for policy and legislature is what politics means to most people, including most workers. On the other hand, the state is structured under capitalism to protect capitalist property at all costs. Changing the ruling party and new legislation only affects basic social relations in a marginal, superficial way. Elections are more about letting off steam and choosing leading personalities than about any substantial change in direction. In fact, elected officials do not really make basic policy, and this is the main problem of Marxists participating in electoral politics and in governing coalitions. Now, historically, within the communist left, there were two main lines on electoral and government participation. The first was laid down, I'm not talking about the Social Democrats, so now I'm talking about the communists. The first, which was laid down by Lenin and adopted by the Communist International in the 1920s, was that the role of communists in electoral politics was very, very limited in bourgeois electoral politics. They were there to propagandize about socialism and expose capitalism, but they do not participate in blocs with bourgeois parties, and they do not participate in the government at any cost. So this was the policy of the Communist International. This changed in the mid-1930s with the United Front against fascism. And here there was a kind of 180-degree reversal, at which point communists were encouraged to block with not only social democrats, but with also bourgeois parties. And this new policy, which made some sense in the context of an anti-fascist struggle when fascism was seen as the main danger, was continued after the Second World War and throughout the ensuing period, even though it made no strategic sense in the West after, with the beginning of the Cold War, when the Social Democrats and the capitalists had no interest in blocking with the communists. To begin with, it was a world of illusion. But what this had the effect of this was to really degenerate and destroy any possibility in the United States of effective Marxist electoral politics. In the U.S. and elsewhere, this United Front electoral politics has been widely discredited within the Marxist left, but no serious alternative electoral strategy has emerged. In practice, this means the broader progressive left falls back to supporting the lesser evil Democrats, while the Marxist left either abstains, engages in sandbox politics by promoting electoral parties and formations with no real mass prospects, or finally rallies around individual progressive Democrats while holding their nose at the fatal compromises these progressives are forced to make to retain office and cred with the party hierarchy. Now I'm going to skip a bunch because I really want to finish and not hold them up. There must be a real break with the National Democratic Party in the United States, which is the party of capitalist liberalism, a wing of neoliberalism which has no real common interest with the working class. Although such a break will need to win over a substantial section of locally based progressive Democratic Party activists, there's no basis for a common agenda for us in any wing of the national leadership of the Democratic Party. In recent surveys, up to 40% of people polled expressed some favorable interest in socialism. This is in the U.S., a recent U.S. poll. Of course, socialism here is left undefined, and many of the respondents' view of socialism is undoubtedly vague and shallow. It's up to Marxists to enrich it and give real content to smash such mass sentiments. If we don't, no one will.
Thanks, Mel. So right now we're going to move to a 15-minute panelist response section, and then because we have a smaller audience, I think actually we should go for a little longer of a question and answer because we can have a bit more of a conversational atmosphere. So anyway, in the order you guys went, Christoph, Boris, and then Mel, you've like a five-minute response.
Okay. So I'd like to pick up on a couple of comments made by Boris. The first one is I agree with. The second one I disagree with, so it should be interesting, hopefully. The first one is when you said the people in the DDR did not really expect capitalist reunification to happen or didn't expect the effects of capitalist reunification. That's very true. I remember talking to workers in Berlin in the eastern part, and I kind of sketched what I think will happen unless Leninist Party takes power, and I painted a very bleak picture. And they looked at me like, who is this party pooper, you know? We just had this great event. And he's painting this dire picture of the future, unless we create a Leninist party. And the reason for that response was very simple. Perhaps I'm simplifying a little bit, but let me explain it this way. For decades, the people had been told that they lived in a socialist paradise, pretty much like the Soviet Union. And after a while, they began to realize it isn't really a socialist paradise. So what the Stalinists told us wasn't exactly true. We found the opposite was true. It was actually lacking in many things. The same rulers also told them that Western capitalism was terrible, that there were wars going on, there was poverty, there was unemployment, there was racism. But remember, it was the Stalinist rulers who told us this. So we choose to believe the opposite of what they told us because they haven't been truthful to us. So they literally did not want to believe any of the stuff they had heard in the previous 40 years about how bad capitalism was. They would not want to listen to you because they believed that it was going to be okay. It was a very hard message to get across. The second comment that Boris made, I actually disagree with. You said that the Stalinist elite was happy for capitalist restoration. I think that is true for some sections of the Stalinists, but not in its majority or in its totality. I believe that the Stalinists actually rested on the planned economy. They derived their privileges from the existing society, and they could not simply switch over to capitalism wholesale. In fact, capitalism has no need for a huge bureaucracy that administers inequality. And a lot of Stalinists understood this, not because they were necessarily fiery socialists, but because they wanted to protect their own privileges. So not all of the Stalinists went over towards capitalism, definitely not. And I think the events in the Soviet Union in 1991 are a prime example of this. So in 91, the August coup happened, when a section of the more hardcore Stalinists around Yanayev actually arrested Gorbachev, set up the emergency committee and said, you know, we're taking charge of this because things are going downhill at the moment. We need to kind of reestablish a little bit of order here and kind of keep things in check. What they did was pretty much try to arrest the pro-capitalist course of Gorbachev. They wanted to maintain the status quo. That's all they wanted to do for their own narrow interests of privilege. But they wanted to maintain the Soviet Union and its planned economy for that very reason. And I think that was an example of a section of the Stalinists defending the status quo, and they actually came into conflict with Yeltsin, who was no one else than the spokesperson of Wall Street. And I think that was a showdown in which the Stalinists split the section of Yanayev and the emergency committee versus those who supported Yeltsin. And I think as Trotskyists, we had a side in that. We sided with those who fought against Yeltsin. We sided with those who wanted to maintain at least the status quo. For Trotskyists, the defense of the Soviet Union was very serious, and that was the last kind of chapter, I think, in the story of the Soviet Union in the event of August 91.
Okay. Well, I didn't say that every single Stalinist bureaucrat supported capitalist restoration. And by the way, Christoph, I made this exception for the GDR especially, but I think there was a specific reason why, for example, quite a lot of GDR top bureaucrats did not support restoration of capitalism, unlike in Russia. And the answer is that there was already West German capitalism available, so the big West German corporations are going to come, and they're going to take over industries, they're going to take over properties and so on, and East German bureaucrats were no idiots. So they understood from the very beginning that they couldn't compete on that ground. So that's why they didn't go for that, and it was very interesting to see how many people of that type joined PDS, the Party for Democratic Socialism, not because they were so consciously anti-capitalist, but rather because they knew that there was no space for them in this new, brave new world of German capitalism. However, in the case of Russia, it was very different. Recently, there were there was some research done in other Eastern European countries, and what is becoming evident is that most of the bureaucracy did extremely well under the new regime. And of course, it was divided, because imagine if you are running, for example, an industrial section of the party bureaucracy, of the party committee, you end up quite possibly actually privatizing the enterprises in your favor. But if you're running the ideological department, what you are going to end up with? You're going to end up with privatizing the collected works of Comrade Brezhnev. You know? So what's your gain? What's your interest? Of course, these people who were either the ideologues, of course, they resisted. Mm-hmm. And of course, military very often resisted. The security services resisted. So it's a very clear, it's a story of interest. And in Russia, it's very interesting because every Russian province had the first party secretary, as you know, who was the real head of the province, not the official state leaders, but of the province, but the party secretary of the province was the boss. What happened under Yeltsin? He appointed all these people to be the governors of these very same provinces, and many of them continued till the period of Putin. And finally, speaking about Gorbachev, you see, this whole August situation was a bit of a joke. That's why this so-called GKCP, the so-called coup, conservative coup, failed, was never done seriously, and it was very clear that Gorbachev was, in a certain sense, also part of the game. So it was never really arrested. He kind of agreed to be kind of put out of the game for a while, that to let the others try. If you try, okay. If you don't try, okay, I come back. He came back, but unfortunately, the other guy was already in charge. It was Yeltsin, another ex-party boss, by the way. Don't forget it. And, finally, one point I also want to make is that the importance of the welfare state is something which cannot work as a mobilizing factor on its own unless you have to mobilize and organize and fight for it. And this is an important lesson. So you see, in a certain sense, now it's right. It's happening right now. The slogan of the new welfare state is becoming a mobilizing slogan for a broad coalition on the left today in Russia. Just because people now are beginning to understand that this is something to be achieved, this is something to be fought for. But the generation of the which was actually the instrumental central for the events of 1989 and 1991 did not see that situation that way. They saw that as something which was guaranteed, and they thought they were going to have capitalism with all the consumer goods and with the liberal democracy, and at the same time they're going to keep their jobs and they're going. Yeah, I remember speaking to workers, and what was more than that, that some workers said, we need more unemployment because there are so many lazy workers around. And these were workers from Tolyatti Automobile Factory. And I asked them, are you not afraid that you will go unemployed? They said, no, everybody will need cars. Actually, and then there were miners sitting next at the same workers' congress. It was a workers' congress, actually. There were miners sitting in a different row. They started laughing. I said, who will need their cars? Their cars are useless. Their cars are junk. They have to be fired, all of them, these guys. They have to go unemployed. I said, what about you? I said, we produce coal. Everybody will need coal. There is no way miners can go unemployed. Unfortunately, both sides happen to be wrong. Yeah. Okay.
Mel?
Yeah, I'm very interested and fascinated by these details, which I didn't know. I mean, but the question seems to me, I would like to get back, why did this occur in 1989 and 91? Why didn't it occur in 79 or 69? I mean, you know, there's too much. I mean, I think we need some kind of historical perspective on the broader unfolding issues that came about. I mean, in some sense, East Germany wasn't economically any worse off in 1989 than it was in 1979 or 1969. The Soviet Union wasn't any worse off in 1999 than it was in 1969 or 1959 or 1949, or certainly 1929, where there was mass poverty and starvation. So something must have happened on the international level, on the fundamental balance of forces, that generated this crisis, and that's I didn't hear that from any of you guys. That's what I'm, you know, what I'd like to talk about a little bit, you know.
Okay. Thank you, guys. So we're going to go to question and answer. One thing I had forgotten to mention was that the moderator takes the first question in the platypus panel, so I reserved that right. So I had sort of a two-part question, one sort of more backward-looking and one more sort of germane to the moment of 1989 and sort of looking forward and drawing lessons from it. Mel, you sort of raised, in a way, the backward-looking question I had wanted to ask of really what led to 89 from the perspective of the left, because oftentimes when the topic of 1989, 91, the fall of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc is brought up, it's parsed in terms of, you know, 89, 91 happened, and then the left collapsed. Instead, it seems to be rather that the weakness of the left was a direct cause in sort of allowing things to happen, and that the left was unable to avert that. So I would want to ask about sort of the general historical problems that led the left to the state where it wasn't able to defend against restoration and the hopes for reform were foiled. And reform on the basis of socialism and the planned economy. And the second question about 89 itself is, you know, Boris, I remember we were talking last night about the Scottish National Party, right? And I remember one of the things you'd said, actually, was, you know, this was the lesson we drew from Yeltsin, right? Is no matter what the sort of progressive or left veneer sometimes on these politicians, there's actually, you know, in the case of Yeltsin, like, capitalist restoration. In the case of the SNP there, you know, capitalism is already there. So, you know, I wonder generally about the way that a lot of leftists at the time looked at people like Yeltsin or sort of the official reform ideology, and because there wasn't an active, viable left that was providing an alternative option, that either positively they bought into it or even negatively, in the way Christoph had described, they sort of accepted the Stalinist line but just negated it and said, well, everything there is wrong, so the West and capitalism must have, you know, something to do with it because they hate it so much. So anyway, those would be the two things I would want to ask to sort of get things going.
Who's going to first?
Why don't we go on?
Okay, it's okay.
Go on.
No, first, to your question, just very, very briefly, we just didn't have time and we were discussing the situation of the left. But, of course, there were very specific reasons. First of all, speaking about the objective side, it's 1973 with the oil prices going up. At this very moment, Brezhnev leadership understands that they don't need any more reforms or any democratization or anything. They can just sell oil to the West. At that very moment, the reintegration, the objective reintegration of the Soviet bloc into the Western capitalist economy is beginning as an objective process, long before it starts happening at the social level, at the political level. And then the debt is becoming a big issue, which was, of course, well known in the case of Poland. But don't forget, it was also the case of Hungary, and to a certain extent, the case of Romania. In the case of Romania, they managed to pay back the debt, like also they did in the Soviet Union. But in Romania, that led to the collapse of living standards in Romania. While in case of Hungary, they kept living standards, but they kind of sold the country to the West, actually. And then they came to the Soviet Union and said, can you bail us out? They said, no, we rather surrender you to the West. No, I mean, it's real. I mean, that were the debates about Russian-Soviet economists in 1989. Because what's the cost of keeping these countries within the Soviet sphere of influence? Mm-hmm. The cost was considered to be too high. So that means that these people were already calculating in capitalist terms. And speaking about the left, I think that the problem, ironically, the problem is very much in 1968 in the West. Because in 1968, with all its tremendous attractiveness as a cultural and historic phenomenon, was also making the first steps in terms of retreating from class politics. The new left was very much oriented towards overcoming class, transcending class, but in the long run, going away from class. And okay, by the way, they did some important things. They discovered the limitations of the traditional Marxist vision of class. Also, they discovered gender as an issue. They discovered cultural politics. They discovered race, by the way, which was... I don't know much about American left, but generally, for the classical Marxist vision, race was not such an important issue. And of course, it was very much thanks to the 1968 when race was discovered for the Marxist and socialist thought as a specific issue. But at the same time, while doing all these important things, the new left also made a very radical step towards moving away from class politics. That's my vision, how I see it now from these days, from today. And I think that was the first stage for the left surrendering its position, and then it didn't manage to produce any kind of economic project for the crisis of capitalism in the 1970s, partly for this very same reason. They had some interesting debates about so-called revolutionary reformism and so on, but they didn't go far enough, and anyhow they surrendered at that level. So the Western left was it moved away from ironically, it moved away from class and moved away from the economy in the long run. And as for us in the East, we never had the experience of organized politics. We had to, I remember ourselves trying to do organizational work in 1989, 1990. We were totally ignorant. We failed everything. Today, we will do it much better, I assure you. But we had to learn the lesson through defeats, you know?
Thank you. Mel, we'll start in this one.
I want to argue a couple of things, maybe a little extreme. One, it may have been the collapse of the Soviet Union began in Iran and Afghanistan, although that's not mentioned here. The Iranian, there was an Iranian, if you remember, there was a revolution Iran against the Shah, in which the left was wiped out by the religious fundamentalists who managed to seize control of that revolution. And that refers to the sort of thing about nationalism and national colonial struggles, the loss of the left. And, of course, Afghanistan was a disaster where the most right-wing nationalist elements defeated the Red Army. I mean, you know, I can't imagine that didn't have a tremendous demoralizing effect within the Soviet Union itself on everybody. The other point, and that goes along with what I was saying. The other thing that I would like to say is that the left moved away, the new left, which I was sort of part of, the Maoist left, moved away from rigorous class analysis and economic issues, partly as a rejection of the Soviet Union. I mean, that the Soviet Union was seen as bureaucratic, oppressive, not a workers, didn't bring anything to work. And so that was the basis on which the new left went towards Maoism, and the Maoists were the dominant element ideologically for a long time. And these things, you're correct, that serious class analysis and clearest economic analysis got. But that was also a function of the weakness of the Soviet Union and internationally. And again, this has to be factored into this. I mean,
okay, Chris. Before you speak, I'll just say we have about half an hour left. We want to try to get as many questions in as possible. So, do you have something to say? Specifically,
I always have something to say, but I have to take a question from the floor.
Yes, okay. Well, why don't you give a response to this, or did you say you wanted to...
Okay. Let's take a question, that's fine.
Okay, so I have two questions aimed at different parts of the panel, and then sort of a comment. The first question is basically aimed at Christoph. So you use the category of degenerate worker state, Mel kind of spoke of non-capitalist development. And I'm sympathetic to the political tradition that it comes from, the Trotskyism. But I admit that I also have problems, like, defending it at a certain level. I mean, I'm thinking I was not so long ago in Cambodia. And I can't deny that in 1975 that the Khmer Rouge overthrew capitalism. But it seems to me that that is a social revolution of such a catastrophic character that the progressive aspects that one might talk about in East Germany can't really say that about a place like that. So I wonder whether there doesn't have to be some question about is a non-capitalist, is the expropriation of the bourgeoisie inherently progressive? I mean, the other case that I think of is, of course, the case of North Korea, right? I mean, I have no doubt that North Korea is in those terms a degenerated worker state, but the question is, like, what is it that one is defending when one is defending that state? The question really, because I already know Christoph's answer to this, is to the other members of the panel, that both of you spoke, obviously, with a lot of praise and sort of advocates who both seem to have admiration for Lenin and the Russian Revolution. But the question is, what role is there for Leninist politics today? I mean, obviously, Christoph is. And I guess the comment part is that the question of nationalism, I'll make it very clear. The question of nationalism was raised, and people spoke of Germany and Russia. So the question would be, how does the question of national self-determination in terms of the nationalist myth of Stalinism, I mean, the legitimizing myth of the DDR was anti-fascism because it wasn't a nation state. And then in Russia, of course, the Russian Revolution happened in Russia, but in the rest of East Central Europe, it was often seen as a foreign imposition. I'm thinking particularly of Poland, right? And I'm wondering how that plays into the narrative.
Thank you.
Maybe we'll collect more of my questions and then we'll answer.
More questions?
Yeah.
Okay.
It makes more sense. We'll take more questions.
Then. Pam, Jason, and then I'll, after this answer, I will call on you two, okay?
Okay. Maybe it's related to the first question that Richard posed, but I would put it differently. So, you know, I understood that there was this defense of the social gains made in places like the DDR, and on the other hand, there was this emphasis by Boris of the social experience of the USSR that you say atomized, created a society of individualists that... Now, you seem to suggest that it's because people didn't have to struggle for their, you know, these welfare state gains, these, like, socialist gains. Now, I mean... So on the one hand, you have the sort of like objective kind of historical gains of actual social institutions that seem to suggest greater freedom for human beings. And on the other hand, you have the subjective experience that seems to have a regressive character in the capacity of workers themselves, people within the Soviet Union, to have a historical and political consciousness. And both of these conditions are present. Right. So, insofar as the legacy of 1989 is concerned, how do we make sense of this? Because I, for example, the legacy of 1989 seems to me to be negative on the one hand, insofar as it's a history that overpowers a conversation about political Marxism, and that people that are of our generation that didn't sort of exist when this whole historical experience kind of has to, we have to sort of like undo or try to explain so much before you can get to a conversation about Marxism. And yet on the other hand, you know, this suggestion that the subjective experience under the USSR was actually not progressive, but in some ways regressive, how do we make sense of this? The sort of potential objective gains, but subjective regression in one, under the USSR.
Okay. Let me just make a correction. I will go here, and you guys can answer this, and then Jason and the gentleman here will come after the response. And then, if there's time, I'll ask you too, okay? So let's go again from Boris Mel to Christoph.
Well, first speaking about Cambodia, just recently I was at a... I was talking at... teaching at Moscow School of... social sciences, and one of the students came back from Gaidar Forum. It's a kind of meeting of new liberal economists who represent both the government and the opposition in a total consensus. And one of the speakers at the forum, as my student reported, and said that only 10% of the population are really moving the economy further. These are so-called members of creative class. And all others, like all these miners and truck drivers, and all, they're just pulling us backwards. So they are kind of parasites who are exploiting the creative class. So that's kind of vision of the world, right? These, and when he reported that to us, the student, the other student listened to them and to him and said, well, you know, I'm beginning to understand Pol Pot. Now coming to what Pam said, you know, the same experience can be both positive and negative. It's dialectic. It's how the world is moving. That you will never have things simple. You never have. Even when you're saying, nothing fails as failure, nothing succeeds as success. But also it's true in terms of social change. When you have a social change, it's a contradictory process, which involves also negative aspects. The point is you have to be honest about it, you have to understand that, you have to work on that, you have to try to overcome that. The revolution has repressive and authoritarian aspects. By the way, does it mean that you have to abandon the revolution altogether? No, it doesn't mean that. But also doesn't mean that you have to reject the fact that these aspects are present in the process. Just have to work on these problems. And I just give you one example, that today among Russian workers, you know which is the most popular name these days among Russian workers and Ukrainian workers who are resisting the army in Donetsk? The most popular name, unfortunately, is Stalin. And you know why? Because they say he delivered. He delivered. And then people can say, well, we know everything about Gulag and so on. We don't want Gulag back and so on. But he achieved something. Mm-hmm. Speaking about the... we have to understand that you have to win struggles. Certain things, you have to fight and win. Unless you win, all that is just nonsense. And... the very final thing here is that when we are speaking about welfare state, again, I want to make it clear that I quoted Anna Ochkina, who made developed this concept. She said that welfare state, all social democratic or Soviet welfare state, it was both cases of so-called passive democracy, which was that there were certain democratic achievements, but which were given to the people, and which were not administered by the people. So the struggle for the welfare state today must be associated with active democracy. And it's not just about certain things being given by the state to us, but nothing has to be just given. It has to be administrated, organized from the bottom up.
Yeah, your remarks was why I wanted to focus on the trade union thing, what I did. I mean, what you're talking about is trade union consciousness. And I think my month in the Soviet Union in the mid-60s, the only time I was there, but I did manage to talk to a few workers. I had some contacts through CP contacts, is that the mentality was trade unionist. I mean, they knew about their own welfare, and they were very conscious of that, and they were conscious of the fact that the state provided them, but it was a bargain. I mean, they made a bargain, you know, you make a bargain with the boss, you make a bargain, you know, he gives you this and you give him that. And that's not socialist consciousness. I mean, you know, I think that there was the fact that the Soviet working class in large numbers, or almost no numbers, rose up to defend the old system as it was collapsing into capitalism showed that there was very little among the working class, very little socialism. It was a straight union consciousness, which had been fostered by the system, and part of it was the bureaucratism, the lack of workers' actual control, the lack of workers' actual initiative in getting these and sustaining these things, that lapsed into purely trade union consciousness. You know, the trade union leaders will get you certain things, and you support them in return.
Christoph?
So Richard asked, will the expropriation of the bourgeoisie always result in a more progressive state of affairs? I don't think I can answer that question, whether it will always be the case. But I take the starting point as what we have now. We currently live in a fundamentally irrational society. I'm saying irrational because the current economic system is basically driving everything on the basis of the principle of profit. Human lives are basically wiped out for the sake of making more profit, for the sake of the benefit of corporations. Human needs are subjected to what corporate needs are. These are all things that, in my view, are irrational. They are not serving our interests in any way. Yet, we let the society continue. So the rational approach to me is, what do we need to do to put an end to a system that puts corporate profit above human need? Having read a few books and talked to a number of people and walked the planet for a while, I've come to the conclusion that one of the most effective ways of starting that journey towards organizing society for human need is to expropriate the bourgeoisie, that is, the people who own the means of production and run society for their personal gain. That is the first prerequisite, because it will remove that fundamental drive, the principle I talked about. If we are agreed that this is the first step, then that's the main task we need to focus on. There might be other solutions out there, which I'm happy to discuss, but unless we want to continue in a society where our needs are basically meaningless, we have to find an alternative. And I think the Soviet Union represented that alternative in a very real and living way, even though it degenerated. And unfortunately, today, the reference is always towards the sort of degenerated state, the deformed state, the bad stuff. But I think we should also remember that the social gains that still existed in these states were significant, and the deterioration of living standards in Russia since the collapse of the Soviet Union are significant. People are simply dying earlier. People are dying 10 years earlier than they used to. Why is that? It's because their lives have become hell, because capitalism runs their lives now. That is one of the real changes that has happened. And people are forgetting this. But what I'm suggesting is that we need to reverse what has happened. We need to take control and stop an irrational system that destroys us, our lives, and the planet.
Thank you. So, Jason, go first, and gentleman here.
Bertil.
So, Trotsky used the analogy several times of the defending the degenerated worker state to defending a trade union as a worker. And, you know, I think the analogy between the bureaucracies is you know, also poignant in some ways. And so to address the idea of, you know, should we defend the degenerated or deformed worker state, that is the approach I take it from. And I recognize that in a case like North Korea, it may be a lot harder to articulate than a case like East Germany, but I do think that there was something significant in Korean, the Korean government being overthrown in the 1950s. I want to say about the bureaucracy is sort of addressing the point that Mel brought up, that, you know, as a member of a trade union and watching not just the deindustrialization in the U.S., but the general crisis in the unions, that you end up by getting to a point where an organization like the CIO, which was founded on militant struggles and which rejected red baiting at its birth, and yet could capitulate so totally during the McCarthy era and end up by purging out those unions that refused to drive communists out of them, that you end up by gutting the leadership over a period of time to the point where you have a real crisis of leadership because it's just an entrenched bureaucracy. And it's almost like a photocopier where you make a copy and then you take that and you make another copy and you make another copy and you get to this very gray entity. I mean, the Jimmy Hoffas, however corrupt they were, had actually participated in the struggles of the 1930s that won the organization of the CIO. And by the time you get to today's bureaucrats, you know, it's no wonder that the membership of their own unions don't see them as being anybody doing anything other than taking juice from them and perhaps occasionally helping them with a grievance, because it's not possible to imagine them successfully waging a strike and winning. You know, the only experience of a picket line is a defensive one if the workers are locked out. I think similarly, what you get when you get to the late 80s and the early 90s is a case in the Soviet Union where the bureaucracy is so degenerated and there's such a lack of consciousness that whenever you hit these little bumps in the road, there isn't any sort of political consolidation or political leadership. Now, do I think that the bureaucracy ever could have been political leadership? No, I mean, I think that was the nature of it, but there could have been a political struggle. And you know, the tragedy is that Stalin had really done such a good job in the purge trials of eradicating revolutionaries in the Soviet Union that there was a real rupture of continuity and that there wasn't a political leadership that was able to struggle against Stalinism when it entered that period of crisis. And, you know, while Afghanistan was certainly important, I think that the crisis of leadership was the most important thing, really.
Thank you, Jason. Dr. Ullman?
Before I make my non-Marxist comment, let me suggest make clear, I'm a Marxist. I have to say that because I think that really bad luck played a role. We had in the 1980s, this is a way of commenting on Mel's discussion of what happened in the 80s to bring about the collapse in 89. We had in the 80s the two major capitalist countries had the most reactionary leaders in the entire 20th century, for sure. Thatcher in England and Reagan in the U.S. And you can see how they dealt with the opposition in the miners. What happened in the miners' strike in England under Thatcher, and what happened in the air controllers' strike in the U.S. Under Reagan. These were not the people who were open to compromise with the Soviet Union. So what do we have in the Soviet Union? We have the first great compromiser among Soviet leaders since Lenin. We have someone who is rational and who thinks that maybe a deal can be made. But he's trying to make a deal with two people who treat him the way they treated the miners in England, the way they treated the air traffickers in the U.S. And none of the deals that he did make have been followed through on by the West, like the movement of NATO up to the borders of the Soviet Union, which is one great achievement that the Gorbachev remains proud of. This combination was just horrible to deal with the objective conditions which took place in that time of the kind that people have been discussing. But I want to suggest that like occasionally there is an appearance of history of someone who has the strengths or the weaknesses, which contributes mightily to a situation that where an individual with great power can have a decisive effect. This happened in the 1980s because three positions were held by people who never should have been interacting in the way that unfortunately they had to interact, which contributed to the, I think, collapse of the communist regimes at this particular time.
Thank you. So, Boris?
But Bertel, do you think it's an accident? I think there was a certain logic in that happening.
Yes, but also there's more than the logic. I do think that Reagan and Thatcher were really unique reactionaries. And Gorbachev certainly was so different as a compromiser from any of the Soviet leaders who came before.
No, but I think that Gorbachev was very much also the product of the degeneration of the system. And you see, one big problem which we faced when we discussed the 1930s, that all these personalities, no matter which side they took, all these personalities in the inner struggles within the Bolshevik Party, whether these were the left opposition people, Trotskyists, or whether they were Bukharinists and the right-wing tendency, or whether they were Stalinists, like Stalin himself or Mikoyan and so on, they were important personalities, which were produced by a revolutionary struggle. All of them had this experience of fighting real struggles. And of course, by the way, that was one of the reasons why Stalin was so brutal, because he knew that these people were also very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he didn't find any better way to get rid of his opponents, given the strength of his opponents. You see, what kind of people did we have in 1980s in the Soviet Union? I mean, the generation of degenerated bureaucracy. And by the way, in Revolution Betrayed, there is a very interesting paragraph when Trotsky says that, well, one possibility is that at some point bureaucracy degenerates to such an extent that it actually carries out some kind of restoration of capitalism, which is exactly what happened, but Trotsky himself didn't believe it. He made this prophecy, but he didn't believe it. He thought he went too far. Just, it's mm-hmm. probably not possible. It's what? Just a theoretical hypothesis. But Gorbachev, since he was out of power, I met him quite a few times. He's a very nice person as a human being. As we say in Russia, a nice person is not a job description.
Mel?
Yeah, I mean, what Bert said is right in the sense that I think the fact, not that these right-wingers, Thatcher and Reagan, outmaneuvered Gorbachev. I mean, it's that the system produced in Russia a weak leader because the contradictions were of such a character that only a Gorbachev could emerge because there were these forces on all sides and he was the only one who could sort of stand above the conflict for a while until they got rid of him. Whereas in the case of Reagan and Thatcher, they were produced by a neoliberal policy that needed them. I mean, you know, they couldn't have had what happened in the 80s couldn't have happened without them, and you needed fanatic and very ideological right-wing leadership at that moment, like when, you know, Mussolini came along in Italy. I mean, in some sense he was an accident, but in some sense he fit the social conditions. So I think that, you know, there was an element of chance, but I think that the social conditions, I mean, the social conditions choose the politicians who are successful, I think. I mean, it's not the other way around.
Christoph?
Yeah, I think Boris made an important point insofar as the bureaucracy itself in the 1980s was, of course, made up of people who had less of an affinity, less ties with the huge event of the October Revolution. They were themselves, as you said, a sort of degenerated, and degenerates of degenerates, if you like. And I think...
Copies of the copies.
Yeah, yeah, they kind of get grayish towards the end. And that, of course, meant also that the whole... That was true for the Stalinist elite, but there was also the problem of the atomization of the working class under Stalinism. They also had lost some of their tradition. And I think if you look at uprisings against Stalinism in the past, there was a much stronger element in earlier attempts to overthrow Stalinism. If you look at the DDR in 1953, or especially Hungary in 1956, which was explicitly pro-socialist, which was made up of Hungarian workers running society, creating Soviets that were basically making society run, and they were conscious of the fact that they did not want capitalist restoration. That was Hungary in 1956. The Czechoslovakia in 68, there were many pro-socialist sentiments in those events too. But over time, the working class forgot its own roots, its own history, its own power and its own mission, because there was no one there to educate and re-educate the working class. The political education that the working class in the DDR or the Soviet Union received was rubbish. It was not political education. It was a kind of misinformation and a kind of make-believe. It was half true in historical facts and half lie. The working class in those states didn't really have a sense of this is our state, we accomplished that. They lost that belief a long time ago because they weren't really involved in running that society. And that was one of the problems that I think, especially in the DDR, that the mood changed so quickly from a somewhat naive pro-socialist sentiment towards here's the Western capitalist democracy, let's take that because it looks okay.
Wasn't that also the problem of Western social democracy? It was also very much following the same the same trend, just like losing the capacity to fight.
But I have real differences with that. I mean, first of all, the anti-communist movements in Hungary and Poland didn't begin. They were continuous from the war. There was very fierce opposition. A leading figure in the Hungarian Revolution was Cardinal Manzetti, who was a fascist. I mean, it wasn't simply that all the forces there were progressive. And so I think that the struggle to survive of those regimes was a continual one, Poland and Hungary and stuff like that, against not only there was a dissatisfaction of their own population, but there was also very strong right-wing political forces that were never wiped out and that continued and played a role in this. I mean, I think that it wasn't simply a spontaneous development at all.
Okay, so we have the room until 8. I'm going to try to sneak in two more very quick questions from the back here. Hopefully the responses can be somewhat short. And be aware that after the event, we'll be going out to get drinks at Vol de Nuit.
Will there be some food there, maybe? Or?
Is there food?
There's food around there.
Okay, we'll figure this out. Let's just get the two questions in. Let's try to answer them quickly before 8 or like a minute after 8, and then we'll talk after and convene for going. So,
could you call Dave?
Hold on. Could Jamie and...
It
doesn't matter.
It does matter.
And you raised your hand in the woman in the back. Okay.
Should I start or...
Sure, just go.
Okay. Actually, I was just a follow-up question to what you said earlier, that the bourgeoisie should be expropriated. And I was wondering what you think the way should be, in what way that should happen or could happen. Because the way I see it, there's two ways. There's two kinds of power. There's more subversive persuasion kind of power, but that is a privilege to those that are already in power. And then there's the more violent kind of power that is, I would say, easier accessible. And yeah, and what do you see as a road?
Okay, and Jamie, and then quick answers, please, so we can.
So Christoph brought up the idea of irrational society, or people. Specifically the working class working in opposition to their own best interests. And I'm wondering whether it might be more useful to consider the rational elements in a problem like that. In other words, what does it mean to kind of charge a people with working in their own best interests, working towards their own best interests, when there might be a kind of obfuscation of what those interests might actually be? And so kind of in this vein, how might we consider, the failure of the Soviet Union in light of something like a failure to adequately conceive of the role of ideology in politics?
Okay, so Boris?
Well, to be very, very fast, I don't think that capitalism is irrational. I think it's a very limited rationality, which contradicts my ideas of reason. I think capitalism is unreasonable rather than irrational, because there is a rationality, but it's a very limited rationality. Profit motive is rational, but it contradicts the reason of society as a whole. So every individual acts rationally, and it creates chaos and disaster at the level of society as a whole. I think that's the answer. And speaking about the Soviet Union, ironically, Soviet bureaucracy at some stage also behaved the same way, being technically rational in terms of technical planning, for example, but forgetting about the social needs of a society as a whole. That was one of the reasons why this whole thing started disintegrating.
Thank you. Mel?
I think that rationality is... it's a question of means versus ends. I mean, if your ends are capitalist, then the system is very rational.
Yeah,
it's brutal and terrible in many ways, but it knows how to preserve itself. And it's the fact that it has existed for 200 years and is, you know, and remains dominant in the world shows that it knows how to do that. I don't quite understand what rationality beyond what it means beyond that. It's a, to me, it's a instrumental concept.
Christoph, last comment, and then Rob.
Yes. So the expropriation of the bourgeoisie, which I think is the first step towards liberation. The bourgeoisie will not relinquish power peacefully. They will not go through elections or persuasion. It will take a revolutionary party that has the confidence and support of the proletariat in order to stage a revolution, an armed uprising, which will be messy, bloody, and violent in order to smash the existing state. It will not be a nice event, but it will be an event that will be absolutely necessary in order to put an end to rational capitalism. And that, I think, is the only perspective for humanity.
All right. Thank you, everybody. So let's convene sort of outside the room here. We'll get things shut down, and we'll disseminate information about where we're going to go for drinks, food, and so on.
Raj, may I ask you one quick practical question? Are they publishing Trotsky fully and completely now in Russia? And are
fully and completely, no, but of course the Revolution Betrayed is published and republished.
That is published in
Russia. Quite a few, more than one edition. And Communism and Terrorism was published.
Right.
And maybe something else, but not any kind of collected works or anything.
Right. But what portion of the political intellectuals or academics really talk about Lenin, Trotsky, Stalin?
Oh, quite a lot.
Oh, do they? Oh, okay. All right.
But not necessarily from the leftist position.
And what is Mr. Volkoganov writing about?
Volkoganov, fortunately, is out. He died, actually.
Oh, did he? I didn't know
and
that.
And fortunately, his ideas are forgotten.
Oh, they are? Okay, yeah. Good.
No, but still, but in general, the problem is that Russian elite is promoting all sorts of conspirological explanations. And and if you watch Russian television, it's all telling you that Bolsheviks are German spies and so on and so on. Really?
Oh, are they? Oh, aha. Okay. Thank you for your comments. I appreciate it.
So we have to look at the right?
Yeah, not too long.
Okay, this is what the SD cards were in. Okay. Do you want to put the rest in here?
No, I'll just leave these in.
Will keep running. What's that? The sound.
They work.
I don't know, we'll find out about the SD card. Do you want this as your phone?
I would like a map. I need to try my glasses, but that's all there was.
Okay.
I put two new ones in because
it must have come out of the recording.
Yeah, I took one out of the recording.
Okay.
I wasn't working.
Okay. Do you need me to take
the
one out?
Where's Josh? Josh?
We have our fingers crossed.
Maybe.
Probably a part of the machine. Yeah, because the.